svetkutaveti deva deva na vedmiyaham sarvatomukam ayata teja parama darunam. O Lord of Lords, how is it that this dangerous effulgence is spreading all around? Where does it come from? I do not understand. Okay, Prabhupada's purport. Anything that is presented before the personality of Godhead should be so done after due presentation of respectful prayers. That is the standard procedure, and Sri Arjuna, although an intimate friend of the Lord, is observing this method for general information. So, this purport, I'm also going to cover the next purport text today also. This is a kind of general background. Maybe some people are coming here. Of course, again, in the first two cantos of the Lotus Feet of Krishna, and it goes up higher and higher with higher... The fundamental verse of the Bhagavatam, the Paribhasa Sutra, is Ete Chamsa Sakal Pumsam Krishna's Tu Bhagavan Swayam. So there's so many Vedic literatures, and I think I mentioned this, that of course the Catalogus Catalogorum, it's a bibliography that all the Indologists keep, and when it was last published, it had over 160,000 known ancient Sanskrit texts, in different libraries, Maharaj and Mysore's library, British Museum, and they give a little description of the content, the size, like that. So I kind of mentioned this one point. My friend Dr. Bandhopadhyay from the University of Calcutta was kind of laughing, and he responded something like, he said, Hanuman Swami, the Hindu Varanasi University alone has over 100,000 untranslated texts. So it's vast, unlimited. And of course, these you may find so many things on architecture, mathematics, Ayurveda, so many things. So Srimad Bhagavatam is the essence. The whole, it talks about material nature, but all in terms of self-realization. And then the first canto, again, is like a preface. It tells us what the purpose of the whole book is, why it was being written, who is the principal professor, who is the principal student, and what are the circumstances under which the class is taking place. So first canto, I guess, is a fantastic job of that. So here in this chapter, we see that the circumstances that the Kali Yuga is coming, the battle of Kurukshetra is over, and so now, at the very end, then Ashvatthama, kills Draupadi's sons, one son from each Pandava, and he has this sword that he got from Lord Shiva, which must be really quite an incredible thing. And with that, he was able to behead all the children, and Duryodhana wasn't satisfied with this. And then Arjuna promises Draupadi she can take her bath standing on Ashvatthama's head, his head, after he cuts it off, So he heads off after Ashvatthama and his chariot with his magical horses. And then Ashvatthama then starts to flip out because he's being pursued like this and that, and Arjuna's, like death personified. So next, and then he throws a Brahmastra. And Arjuna sees all this incredible effulgence. But before he asks Krishna, what is this, what's going on, he offers the beautiful prayers before this, which identify Krishna, put the proper relationship, proper respect, and then Krishna can answer like that, and so on. So beautiful prayers before this. The next text, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Vete Dhang Dronaputrasya Brahmam Astrang Pradarshitam Naiva Sao Veda Samharang Prana Bhada Upastite. The Supreme Personality of God has said, know from me that this is the act of the son of Drona. He has thrown the hymns of nuclear energy, Brahmastra, and he does not know how to retract the glare. He has helplessly done this, being afraid of imminent death. So what is the layer here in the word by word? Sanskrit words. Idam, Brahma Astra, exhibited, Asau, He, attraction, extinction. So probably comes from the previous text there, like that, the word for glare, effulgence. Purport, Prabhupada says, the Brahmastra weapon is similar to the modern nuclear weapon manipulated by atomic energy. The atomic energy works wholly on total combustibility. And so the Brahmastra also acts. It creates an intolerable heat similar to atomic radiation. But the difference is that the atomic bomb is a gross type of nuclear weapon, whereas a Brahmastra is a subtle type of weapon produced by chanting hymns. Yeah. Yeah. I think for us too, in our Western tradition, the Vedic mantras and so on, they're like, you know, devotional for different demigods and things like that, probably very personal in most of their content. But I think in America we think of hymns, we think of, like, you know, Rock of Ages or Amazing Grace, something like this, you know, which are devotional, they have some idea. But the hymns of the Vedas are extremely precise in their content and everything else like that. And of course this is passed down in South India in families or as professor to student. And they chant them, all the mantras, you know, for Agni, for Varuna, for different things like that. Forward, then they learn to, they memorize to chant them backwards, then they memorize to chant every alternative syllable or something like that. And of course then every now and again they all get together and chant these things at the same time, so it's very difficult for everybody to make the same mistake at the same time, you know. And so therefore this is you know, undeniably the most what's a durable certifiable form of passing these things down. Because an inscription or something, even though it's written in stone, somebody can make one mistake and everybody else, you know, follows like that. Yeah. And so UNESCO, I guess it was them, UNESCO, they declared this particular heritage to be, like, you know, one of the heritages of mankind, and therefore of course is eligible for all kinds of support and donations and stuff like that. So these hymns of course are very precise. Ahai, Rudra, and how they're pronounced. Yeah, we'll go on here, probably explains more, I think. It is a different science, and in the days gone, by such science, was cultivated in the land of Bharatvarsha. The subtle science of chanting hymns is also material, but it has yet to be known by the modern material scientists. Subtle material science is not spiritual, but it has a direct relationship with the spiritual method, which is still subtler. Of course, you know, chanting mantras and hearing and chanting is a basic connection. But Prabhupada also, when it's describing the qualities of Suta Goswami, the sages before they, you know, when they're trying to invite him to be their guru in Naimisharanya, they're glorifying his different qualities. And they say this, that you're very expert in all the Puranas, but you're not so expert in these technical chanting of these mantras. And so Prabhupada in the purport explains that these are both very necessary in society. There should be these brahmanas who can do these things, you know, and so that people then can live a peaceful, natural life. If you have to search for your food all day like an animal, you know, and have sex once a year, and that's all you're going to be, because all day long it's just you're doing that, searching for food, you know. There's no time for anything else. And the animal's satisfied with that. If he goes out every day, looks here, looks there, and fights a little bit, and fills his belly, and then, okay, and once a year, a little sex, it's a good life, you know. But a human being is given higher intelligence and not satisfied with that, you know. So if we spend all time, like, taking care of these material necessities, and we become very dissatisfied with ourselves. You know? So therefore, it's very important to have these abilities, like, you know, Vastu Veda, you know, granite, mathematics, Vastu Veda, architecture, Ayurveda, medicine, Danda Veda, political science, you know, or Astra Veda. You know? And these teach us how to deal with the material nature in a very simple, practical fashion, and you know, do these things, you know, take care of ourselves, defend ourselves, take care of our health, have proper shelter, which is stimulating, you know, for higher spiritual development. And that's the other factor, is not only to satisfy these basic necessities so we have time, but it satisfies them in such a way that they're all progressive, you know, for spiritual life. In Vastuveda, there's the Maya Dhanava Prakash and the Vishvakarma Samhita. There's, you know, it's maybe the exact other way around, Samhita for the other guy. But there are two texts, and Maya Dhanava is for architecture, Vastu, that will stimulate material enjoyment. So like building like big luxury hotels or gambling casinos, there's certain ways that make people stimulated to enjoy. And then Maya Dhanava, then what's the other one? Vishvakarma, his treatise is Vastu for developing simplicity, purity, renunciation, austerity, like that. You know, and if we do that, then we come, you know, it's connected. So the mantras and the hymns, you know, are connected in the fact of how we do hearing and chanting as part of our process. But then they're also connected in the fact that, you know, one leads to the other. You know, these, the technical mantras of the Vedas produce a well-being which naturally inclines us to understand, you know, the higher truth of spiritual life. Subtle material science is not spiritual, but has a direct relationship with the spiritual method, which is still subtler. A chanter of hymns knew how to apply the weapon as well as how to retract it. That was perfect knowledge. But the son of Dronacharya, who made use of this subtle science, did not know how to retract it. He applied it, being afraid of his imminent death, and thus the practice was not only improper, but also irreligious, like that. You know? So here it's interesting because, like one complete package here, and Prabhupada says, as the son of a brahmana, he should not have made so many mistakes, and for such gross negligence of duty, he was to be punished by the Lord himself. So this is, you know, a little bit sophisticated because, again, you know, Ashwatthama knew that his father, Dronacharya, you know, loved him. He was his son and probably, you know, quite attached. But then when they grew up and everything else, then Arjuna and the Pandavas showed up. He started teaching them from teenage. And Ashwatthama had to accept the fact that, you know, his father loved Arjuna more than he loved him. And of course, this is quite a thing for a boy to accept, you know, that my father loves the student who kind of came into the house here after 14 years of, you know, being with my daddy, and then he surpasses me. My father loves him more than me. And of course, Arjuna may have been humble and everything else, and Ashwatthama may have, you know, felt, you know, he's a nice person, and this is, I guess, justified. But some other also may have been some feeling of like, having to, you know, put up with this. And then what did the Pandavas do? They took this knowledge Dronacharya had given them, and they used to fight against their own guru. And then beyond that, they actually didn't cheat it to kill him. You know, and so, you know, it's quite understandable, you know, that Ashwatthama would be disturbed by this whole situation and to feel like he was only justified to, like, you know, cause emotional pain to them that they caused to him. And by killing Draupadi's children, their children, like that, and so on. So in some ways, it's not like there's real justification why he did it. You know? But as a brahmana, a son of a brahmana, he shouldn't have like fallen in that kind of illusion. He should have seen why, how things happened, who Krishna was, you know, and everything else like that. And so the purport's indicating it wasn't just like an accidental fall down. Prabhupada says, for such gross negligence of duty, he was to be punished by the Lord himself. So it seems that the situation, he's a devotee, and ourselves too, sometimes we just confuse and make a mistake, and it's ignorance. And okay, then we get forgiven very quickly, you know, so on. Maybe we've got to do a little compensation just because, you know, it happened. But in general, there's no real hard feelings. You know, of course, Prabhupada manifests so many times. But in Ashwatthama's case, there was actually some, he should have known better. He was a brahmana, and because of that situation, training, his consciousness should have been pure enough so that he actually, you know, appreciated the situation and could act properly and so on. you know, you shouldn't kill, you know, children like that and so on. You shouldn't release a weapon which can cause problems for the entire universe if you can't, you know, withdraw it and control it like that and so on. You know? And also, because he was a Brahmana, he shouldn't have been afraid of death. The Kshatriyas, they have an intuitive appreciation that they aren't the body. Otherwise, how can they risk their life, you know? Death before dishonor, like that, you know? And then, of course, the idea that this very much they were trained, they did austerities, and they got some impression that we aren't the body, and when we die for the right cause, we get a good result, you know, like that. But their knowledge is more or less intuitive. It's not scientific, you know. So sometimes they become confused about bodily identification, and they get involved in lascivious sexual relations and eating and that kind of, you know, that aspect of the confusion. Other times in this situation, you know, the Dronacharya or Lakshmatama should have understood I'm not the body and this and that, and I shouldn't go around risking the whole universe, you know, this just to protect my body, you know, like that and so on. So killing the children, and of course it probably even connected, because once he did this, because of infanticide, he lost his bodily luster and things like that. So probably compounded his ignorance. And then, you know, his ignorance, making mistakes, and, you know, and then he finally released this weapon out of fear for his body, to save his body. You know. And so that's kind of the situation, this point, you know. So what happens then is that, of course, he gets captured, and they take him back, and now Draupadi is not, she's the one who wants to be liberal with him. It's amazing. She's the person who's suffered the most, maybe, but because she's a good girl, she has a very hard time, you know, not being respectful to somebody in a social position like that. His father was a teacher of the Pandavas. He was a Brahmana. She didn't want Kripi, his mother. I guess Kripi is his mother. Kripi Acharya. Yeah. She's a sister of Kripi Acharya. She didn't want her to be crying like she was crying, you know. A very good girl, you know. But Prabhupada said this, you know, this should be put aside. And considering the situation, there should be chastisement and correction like that and so on. We're doing our Bhakti Bhai Bhava program, and we came to this verse. One of our members, you know, Chandamukhi Devi Dasi, she's in Peru. It's interesting because different people identify with different things in the Bhagavatam. There's so many stories that you can find your particular mirror. So the ladies were like identifying with, you know, with Kunti and Draupadi and, you know, Devahuti. And we're identifying with Arjuna, Bhishma, you know, and Kapila, I guess so. Yeah. So in this case, anyway, then Chandramukhi was saying when she read this, it really touched her in her devotional life, because in Peru, for example, somebody may want to give a lecture, you know, and he's a Prabhupada disciple, you know, and the temple president said, well, no, Prabhu, you can't, you know. And so she said she was reacting like, Prabhu, how can you do this? He's a Prabhupada disciple, you know, be respectful. And so the temple president was saying, yeah, but everybody knows he's smoking marijuana, you know. And then she would say, well, Prabhu, even still, he's a Prabhupada disciple. So very difficult. You know, she was seeing as a girl like that, a good girl, not to be respectful to people in the family according to his external features like that. And Arjuna had the same situation because he was a good man. Prabhupada says he didn't want to fight with his family. Even if it came down to sacrificing all these things, in the end, he was a good man. He doesn't want to cause problems. So Prabhupada is saying, no, we have to be intelligent enough to put these things aside at the right time and then deal with people in terms of, you know, more subtle responsibilities. So Ashwatthama, you know, he did all these things. And then, you know, what was his chastisement? It was perfect. Arjuna made the perfect thing of killing him and not killing him. Just like we have teeth going out of our body. And someone like Ashwatthama, he had a jewel, you know, growing out of his skull. His skull was made of bones. I guess it was like somehow or other a crystal was coming out. A very beautiful jewel, I guess. Walk around with this, you know. You know? And so then Arjuna whacked, chopped the thing right off, like that. And really he lost like so much power and potency and everything else, and they drove him out like an animal out of the camp. But that was it. You know, he Krishna chastised him for what he did, and he accepted it. He said, yes, you're wrong. I did a terrible thing. You know, thank you for correcting me. You know? And that was it. Krishna, you know, forgave him, you know, so on. And so much so that he'll stay around this universe, he won't die, and he'll be here at the time of creation of the next yuga, in the Satya Yuga, and he'll be given the honor of being the father of the entire race of Kshatriyas when they're recreated like that. So, you know, Krishna chastised him. You should make too many mistakes for the son of a Brahmana. You haven't acted properly in all these things like that, you know. And so then he chastised him. And he said, yes, you're right. I'm sorry. I've done very heinous things like that. You know, thank you. I deserve much worse. And Krishna said, no, that's okay. That's all. We understand the stress and everything else. And now, you know, you take responsibility. Get back to work. You have many good qualities, you know. So he made him the king then, for the beginning of the race of Kshatriyas like that. So very subtle stories, and we begin to see these stories, and we identify with different ones, and so we can deal with these problems ourselves in devotional service like that. Yeah. The only other thing I was thinking, kind of mentioning, is Prabhupada says it talks about this actual subtle science and stuff like that. And of course, I talked about it before. It's kind of like my mission in life. Yeah. I started electrical engineering, changed to biological engineering, graduated in psychology, first place prize, and started a doctorate and left, and studied karate, improvisational theater, and finally came to Prabhupada with my big fat bag full of zeros, like that, enormous bag full of zeros, and then started going through Bhagavatam and everything else, and I found like all these things, you know, how they could all be related to Krishna and so on. And right from the very beginning, it was just the first kind of book I got in the temple and stuff, reading was Kapila Dev's instructions. So it very much felt like Prabhupada, you know, you should explain this, you know, this is your particular, you know, service. He told Mother Jadarani, be attached to two things, Krishna and painting. You know? And so all over, we've been doing this all over the world, it's our nature, with actually pretty responsible scientific organizations, devotees, and with Srupa Damodar Maharaj. And now myself now, at 65 years old, 65 American years, I think I basically got like, you know, 10 more years. A lot of astrology and everything else says about what it's going to be. The teeth, you know, the heart, you know. Okay. And so it's time for us to really minimize the travel. And again, also, you know, devotees, you get like very strong impressions of things. Like Prabhupada had impressions that Bhaktisiddhanta wanted to take sannyas. So same way, you know, dreams, daydreams, and seem more like Krishna incarnating. But then we confirm it with scriptures. Okay, you're 65 years old. Been in sannyas since, what, 84? Since 20? That's what, 30 years. My goodness, my God, time flies when you're having fun. So 30 years. So my own self, but other people also, you know, going through your life, how much time more do you have? I ask people that, and people stop and think about it, and they can make a very practical estimate. Probably get about, you know, 10 years more, 15 years more, like that, you know? Yeah. And so what are you going to do? You know, get ready for your next life? You know? What do you want in our next life? I would say maybe a lot of us, we want this to find Srila Prabhupada and take part in his Sankirtan movement again, like that, you know? But now we'll come out. You know, like Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Vishnu Janan, what has it got here? Bhagavan. Yeah. We'll be big devotees back from the beginning. We can do something really incredible for Prabhupada or something. Something somehow or other. You know? So, okay, but if you're going to do that, then probably you have the right kind of consciousness so Krishna can catch you and send you on to the right body. If we're too weirded out, he can't do it. He can't break the rules and stuff. You know? So getting our consciousness ready so that when we die, we go to a good body next time like that for service. You know? And also even in this lifetime, you know, kind of, you know, see what we've done. So again, I've given this lecture so many times and seen like very good effect. And for example, one time in Santiago in Peru, we did this at a university, Sankhya, and showing all the, you know, the correlates in Western knowledge in terms of Carl Jung and E.T. Hall, these people, and how they're showing the same thing, you know. But all their information and everything else, the Vedas give a much better, you know, theory to put it all together and to produce very nice sciences where you don't have to kill animals. Biology is the science of life, but nobody kills more animals than biologists. Like that. Yeah, this one big biologist said this. This is the most bizarre thing, oxymoron. You know, are you a biologist? Yeah. I study the science of life. How? By killing. Oh, okay. That makes sense. Like that. Yes. Yeah. I'm going to kill for peace. Okay. So we go on here. So we were giving these lectures in South America one time in Chile. And then about a year later, we're back there. One devotee said, oh, Hanuman Swami, I was studying biology at the university. And the topic of reincarnation came up. And the students were kind of like laughing about, like, what kind of body you get, this and that. He said, but the teacher then said, no, it's very interesting. One of the Hare Krishnas was here last year. And he explained this. And he said that for the first time, I could really see how reincarnation could be like a valid hypothesis, And he said that he explained it, and all the students were looking at it. Okay, through the mind, we get involved in this, like that, so on. So I felt my life was useful, So the ideas are going out, and then, of course, Prabhupada's books, they get that, wow, some guidance, and so many things. I think we see, the world's changed. We definitely, the things that Prabhupada said is happening. And we're just about at a point now where we can just about get it together, of all the different little projects can start connecting up, and we can fight against new problems. And then we can become an institution in the world like the Mormon Church, or Catholics, or something like that, where people listen to our voice. What are the Hare Krishnas going to say? You say something about how society should be organized and how we should teach science, starting from kindergarten. We're talking about that here because in Boise is Radhika Raman, Gopal Hari, Ajay Govinda, all these devotees who went to Oxford and studying science and graduating like that and so on. So they're looking for service now. So if we start writing textbooks for the Goloka Trust or primary school, and I was thinking one nice project for kindergarten might be all the kids plant a seed. What they plant is a tree, like a fruit tree or something, which will live for maybe like 80 years or something like that, or flowers. And so then they their whole life they can, see the tree going through different phases like that as they grow up, keep track of it. And of course science can be taught right along with it, how the plant needs water, needs sunlight, as a person is alive. And at some point it's going to need a bigger pot. And at some point you've got to put it in the ground, And it may also have children, So many things like that. We can produce a very, very, synthetic science, where it's not analytic. Actually, lysis means to cut. And that would mean, catabolism. And ana means to break down. So it means break down by cutting. So synthetic means you understand, you become integrating things. You see what they are, you cooperate with them, you learn that way, which is quite practical. And really it was the time of St. Bonaventura and Thomas Aquinas that this whole analytical approach developed. And the Pope chose Thomas Aquinas, who had this whole analytical approach from Aristotle, and it made him a standard, standard theologian for the church. And Bonaventura was a Franciscan and was working more towards petting the doves and feeding them, making friends with them, and then understanding nature for that kind of system like that. So the science approach and how to learn it and study it, and Sankhya. So what I'm trying to do now is actually put it down in a systematic format, that people can appreciate, and start doing some more writing and stuff like that. These topics that I've been lecturing on, because you see so many people, you know what works, what doesn't work. So it's kind of my phase in life. I pack it all up, put it in place, and then get ready to move on. See what our next situation is going to be. So Sankhya, again, we're mentioning it. It's just the main thing is top down rather than bottom up. In the West, we start with gross matter. We've been taught that that's real. Physics is a normative science. It's a basic one. Chemistry has to be explained in terms of physics. Biology has to be explained in terms of chemistry. And then psychiatry has to be explained in terms of biology. And psychology has to be explained in terms of psychiatry. And sociology comes from the individual minds of people in North America, the United States even. And then society then evolves and produces different literature and stuff. And finally, it produces the idea of God. And isn't evolution wonderful? Is produced the idea of God. They say that. Not like bad mouthing God. He's like, it's wonderful. It's a wonderful concept. It's the opiate of the people. And it's such a wonderful thing God, evolution has produced. I even saw one guy glorifying the Bhagavatam as the highest production of evolution. And he believed it. He knew the Bhagavatam, you know, so on. So the other side is top down. You start with Krishna, and he expands himself, whatever. And for people in the material world, and he's the Purusha avatars, you know. And then if you want to get involved in all this, okay. Then the Pradhan, which is the non-manifested form of the material nature, Pradhan, it exists forever. It's there with Mahavishnu. It's like uncut cloth. It's just sitting there with him. And when it's time to create the material world, Mahavishnu expands himself as Shiradakshai Vishnu, the Holy Spirit, the Paramatma, Lady Luck, you know. And then he enters into the Pradhan, you know, and agitates it for creation, maintenance, and destruction. Rajas, what's the other one? Sattva and Tamas, like that. So that's time. Internally, Kapila Dev says, I keep myself as a Paramatma, and we can contact him by introspection, prayer, meditation, austerity. You know? And then externally, people see me as time, like that. So for a devotee, time is his friend. He sees time as very wonderful and how it's working like that. You know? But for materialists, of course, time is the greatest enemy, everything else in so many ways, and ultimately it's death. You know? But that's his relationship with the Paramatma. You know? And so in the beginning, when it's agitated, the gross elements, the subtle elements are there. First, ahankara, which makes us think that we're separate from Krishna. We can exist separate from Krishna. I don't need mommy and daddy. Okay? And then if you want more, then the more agitation comes, and then intelligence comes, buddhi, some perspective. Now you're separate from Krishna, you're aware of the material nature, and you can understand it. Just look at the word itself. Understand. You know? So what we're getting under here, standing under, is the mind, you know, and the the senses and the sense objects, where we can understand those. And if we stand in the platform of Buddha, Buddhi, intelligence, perspective, like that, you should see everything from 1 inch behind your eyeballs. You know, different kind of suggestions like that from meditators, the Buddhists. Meditation is not what you think, like that. That's the Theosophical Society. It's a nice one. Meditation is not what you think. So the intellectual platform of Socrates and people like that, and Confucius. But okay, but you become stupid, more greedy. Then you go to the mind. You know, and the mind is calculating. His cake is bigger than my cake. You know, how can I get his cake? So your fundamental attitude is greedy. So then the mind, you know, is the mode of passion. It starts creating all these plans and everything else and processes and everything else. If you're more greedy, then you get a gross body, you know, and to actually act, you know, to try and act on this level. And again, it's like the moon is reflected on the earth. He's greedy, so he reflected on the white sands of Rajasthan, more greedy. He gets reflected on the Taj Mahal, more greedy. He gets reflected in the beautiful little pond with lilies and lotus flowers in the Taj Mahal, okay. And now he thinks he's way down in the senses, the sense objects, the smells, like that. So the same way, first we become absorbed in space. I occupy space, like this or that. And I have a certain conception of space. And a portion of that becomes texture. And a portion of that becomes color. And a portion of that becomes fragrance, or what is it? Taste, flavor. And finally, a portion of that becomes fragrance. And so different species of life, the body gets different organs in terms of being able to express or experience, you know, operationally different levels. Of course, cat or a dog has so much more, you know, ability to distinguish, sensitivity, and also the intelligence to categorize and all these different smell, in terms of smell, you know, than we do as human beings. But only for a human being, the subtlest of all these senses is the ear. There's a book called The Acoustical Sense in Animals by Leonard Stebbins. And he goes to hearing in different species. And for devotee, it's very interesting. It's spooky and everything else. Oh my God, you know, what's he going to get different bodies? You know? And so then human being is very subtle. Human being can distinguish a half cycle change in frequency at 2,000 cycles per second. You know, a tiny change, you can distinguish it. And it also confirms, another guy, Ernst Poppel, in Mind Works, he confirms that, you know, that hearing is three times faster than touch, and touch is three times faster, finer than vision. Like that, the hand is quicker than the eye, yeah, and the ear is quicker than the hand. Yeah. So therefore, these, you know, the mantras, hymns—that's the subtlest way to manipulate the material energy. I discussed this with my friend Shankar Shastri. He was like meddler, just everything else, in charge of the Department of Engineering for State University of New York. And he was talking about it. Yeah, this was a whole, for him, it was like shocking. It's a whole new area of science. Because you take some alloy, like it's like, you know, steel mixed with a little chrome or a little molybdenum, and when you're cooling it down, when you're going from a liquid, you know, hot liquid metal, to it forms like a solid thing, then what happens is it forms crystals. It goes into, you know, different crystals. And of course, if you're in the possibility that if you're agitating this with a subtle sound, like that, and a certain structure, a certain kind of thing, it will cause it to go into a packing structure, a different crystal structure that's not stable, or is more intense. It'll push it into something. So very simple science. That's not so expensive. You know, it's like finding out. And of course, the Vedas have all these standing waves and different kinds of sound things described as yantras, and all this kind of stuff. Then you start seeing a whole subtle science for manipulating matter and stuff like that. You know? So some devotees actually starting to get into this now, because these ideas that we're talking about now, they lead to practical experimentation and stuff like that. So Prabhupada says these will be the basis for great discoveries. But if taken from the Bhagavad perspective, and it's always taken in terms of serving Krishna and appreciating how to glorify Krishna, you know, be merciful and help other people like that. You know? But it's possible, quite possible. Again, you know what Prabhupada is saying, two generations, people can be flying on traveling carpets. You know? And the instruction has to be there, you know, from the Vedas and different sources like that, but also from devotees. You know? So that's kind of our understanding of these two verses. That is a whole, you know, sociological and emotional situation which we can appreciate and apply to our lives. And then Prabhupada here is getting into what was not in the text, but getting a little bit talking about, you know, how these things are yet to be discovered, but because of Prabhupada, since they're going to be discovered, you know. If you chant the Maha Mantra improperly, you're going to get all kinds of strange reactions and stuff like that. So Prabhupada's books, it seems like Prabhupada was already realizing this and addressing these different problems that are going to come up in the future. Back in 1974, I mean, there's so many things we didn't even know about these things, you know, but now we're seeing so many problems that have come because this, you know, Vedic knowledge has come to the West, and so demons are also using it, you know, against the Prabhupada. You know? So that's our understanding. Any questions, comments, complaints?
Maharaj, that was a wonderful class. I have actually four questions, but I'm going to wait because I always ask questions. So,
okay.
I have unmuted everyone. Sorry for those over on Skype. We lost you for a few minutes and we got everybody back. Okay, so anyone have any questions or comments?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. Wonderful class as always. You spoke earlier about St. Thomas Aquinas and how he was like appointed by the Catholic Church to be the philosophical, thinker on behalf of the Church in terms of science. And historically speaking, it seems like all the early scientists, they were all Christians before they got into the more gross pursuits of science that we see today. So like, historically speaking, this St. Thomas Aquinas, like, seen as like the founding father of modern science or something? Or how would you see that?
No, it's actually kind of a small number of people. There's Socrates, his disciple Plato, and his disciple Aristotle. And Aristotle was a nice guy, he was a genius, and he just started like, maybe he came from India, everything else. But he started introducing this whole process of nyaya, you know, giving everything a specific name, dividing them into categories, analysis. And then we know, okay, there's so many kinds of insects, there's so many kinds of this and that, you know. And just coming up with all this whole system of putting everything in its place. One thing that's weird is that he was describing insects and stuff like that and their features, which cannot be seen with the human eye. Ordinary person cannot see these features. It was only until later they got microscopes and stuff that could confirm what he was seeing. So if he was seeing with some kind of subtle thing, or one of his servants or himself had some kind of super eyeballs or something like that, that's one thing weird. And Archimedes too, all these guys, a lot of this stuff got lost. So the Arabs had translations of Aristotle's work, and those are what Thomas Aquinas got. You know, and but if I understand, why he was so happy to get them was because the scientific revolution had already started. You know, already the rational approach and stuff like that was getting better results, and was showing it appeared like a lot of stuff in the Bible was just irrational and so on. It didn't match up with what they were seeing. You know, telescopes and all this kind of stuff. So as far as I understand, what happened was that when he got it after the scientific revolution had already started, rationalism, and he thought, okay, this is the way to explain Christianity. So he went through and then tried to put all of Christianity within this rational perspective. And the Pope then said, okay, whatever Thomas Aquinas does, that will be the standard philosophy for all of our, you know, lodge houses, so-and-so's monasteries, and everything else like that. Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand, Maharaj, like, at what point did, like, the early, at what point in history did Christianity establish philosophically that, let's say, that animals have no souls and things like that?
Well, there's a lot of history, and again, the soul, the spirit. Radhika and all the people here, they're saying that actually the Hebrew tradition, you know, which the Christians inherited, and the contributions that Christ is supposed to have made in his like teachings and stuff like that, there's not a lot of cosmology, you know, really a very very systematic or whatever. You know, God created the earth in 7 days. You know. So most of the cosmology they use was simply the Greek and Roman cosmology about the universe and gods and goddesses, everything else, and so. Who are we ultimately? The word spirit comes like from the word respiration or prana. You know, one comes from the other. So when they're talking about the Holy Spirit, it seems like in most cases when they actually know what they're talking about from their tradition, they're talking about prana. You know, and so we have many things we agree with them on prana, about what it is. Other time when they're talking about the soul as psyche, then they're talking about the subtle body for the most part. So they have different, you know, sometimes they say angels have souls like this, animals don't have souls. So where it actually came in, I don't know, but I think it goes all the way back to the Greeks and stuff. You know, before, you know, and then at some point that got mixed up with the Judaic, you know, tradition.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Ah. Yeah, so it goes back to the Greeks even before. Yeah.
But that, you know, when you think about it, the way you're saying it, it makes it a wonder because, like, we know from histories that Socrates believed in the soul and Plato believed in the soul, and but it seems like they were pretty much like the underdogs of Greek philosophy. The way you're saying it,
there were others, Anaxagoras and people like that, but I think even Socrates' idea. Was it that the soul was bad enough, often enough, it could finally be annihilated forever?
That's a new one.
Yeah. I think he was talking about, you know, this and that, but if you just keep on being a bad guy forever, then eventually, yeah, the soul could be permanently just rubbed out. I even heard one professor from Los Angeles talking about this, saying the same
thing.
Was
this,
yeah.
It's right. It says,
it just sounds so much unlike Socrates, the way we hear about Socrates today. In fact, I remember reading in the Dialectical Spiritualism that Prabhupada said he was a Muni, and it just sounds so much unlike Socrates to think such a thought, that the soul could be annihilated.
Yeah, if you look in the Phaedo, that's the last dialogue when they're really discussing what the soul is and stuff like that. I think that's where you'll find it like that. But his thing was, you know, would take, for example, like I was talking to one Jewish guy, and he said, yeah, he said, when you die, the spirit leaves the body, like that, But he said it's like when you pour your coffee out of the styrofoam cup, there's always a little coffee stuck in the cup, you know. So he said, that's the reason why we venerate the body and we don't destroy it and stuff like that. But their idea was also, in different groups, the same thing, is that it's not, you know, you look at what's also like Shakespeare and stuff, it's not quite clear, you know. And a Muni the same way, Muni doesn't have a quite clear idea. So you look at the Phaedo, and Socrates is even saying, it seems to me, you know, it's the best I can do, and stuff like that. So he's admitting himself, he's an honest guy, that's one of the main things, honesty. But look in there, you can read it there, you'll see that impression. But it's not easy. Now you got to be, you know, you reincarnate because of your desires and everything else. But if you just keep on being a rascal for 200 lifetimes or 100 lifetimes and finally just, you know, get rid of the guy. Which the Bhagavad Gita almost presents the same idea, no? You know, they take birth and they never approach me, go down and so on. Yeah.
Well, when you look at it from that perspective, it's easy to understand how the Christians see eternal damnation the way they do. Then,
I guess you got to be immortal for eternal damnation, though, huh?
Yeah, you would have to. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyone else, Prabhu? Anyone else have a question or comment?
Hare Krishna, Guru Maharaj.
Oh, it's Chandramukhi Devi Dasi. She's the one who saw Draupadi. So Draupadi is a good girl.
Guru Maharaj, I was reading Kanto 4 in the box. And it says there that King Anga was like, Srila Prabhupada described him as liberal, this word liberal.
Yeah.
And then I connected this with, for example, when a devotee has a fall down. Here, for example, some devotees of Peru have told me that, okay, do not worry much about that because we are in Kali Yuga, you know, and things are advancing. So these things happen and they like take these fall downs like this word liberal, you know. Like, times are changing, and we don't have to worry much about it. But it seems that with that mentality, we are going to be, like, lazy with our spiritual life. So I want to know how to understand this fall down, you know, because why... devotees now think that things are normal, you know, and we do not take like consciousness about our actions and things like that. I do not like this word like liberal, you know, or things that.
This is something you know that Divyavani is what in our whole community, and one of the people who's helping us a lot of the translation is one lady professor Dora Basan. And she was saying this is a problem because Prabhupada says like many times a liberal Brahmin, and so a liberal Brahmin means basically like a tolerant person. It means merciful in English. That's the context. He's like, he doesn't take other people's offenses and stuff so seriously. So this context in America is English is a liberal Brahmin is somebody who's gentle and flexible and doesn't demand things like so much. And if he's also liberal with himself, but that doesn't mean like he, you know, now that's become a contamination. Well, forgive yourself, you know. But it doesn't usually mean that. It means with other people, usually. And she said, when you translate that into Spanish, when a brahmana liberal, it means exactly what you're talking about. Is it somebody who's like, you know, doing all kinds of things like that. He's not strict within his own standard. So in English, the exact word is, you say he's a libertine, you know. This Brahmin is libertine. And that means that he's engaged in all kinds of these bad activities like that. So what Prabhupada's saying is not that. When it translates in Spanish, it comes across improperly. Is it in Spanish, is there also a libertine? Brahmin, it's already there in Spanish, yeah. Libertino, yeah. But that's what it is in English. So liberal Brahmin, in English, the context is somebody who's, if you go and say something harsh to him, he's, or do this and that, he's forgiving. like that. You know, he's not like a harsh guy, you know. And in general, you know, it's of course every single devotee has always have used every excuse, you know, and you know, love is above the law, Prabhu, and one of our outside organizations, when Sannyasi left ISKCON and his followers, they say, oh, you know, ISKCON has rules and regulations, we have love, so on. Therefore, we can smoke marijuana and everything else because we're above the law. So always in Kali Yuga, any time actually, everybody will start using all these things for an excuse. Yeah. Prabhupada said it's going to happen, this is guaranteed. And then the standard is there. So that's the whole thing, because an Ashvatthama has to go to court, and then the decision has to be how bad is his crime, you know? And then we see, and this is the Bhagavatam, we see story after story after story, you know, about how people were judged, and then the standard is there, you know, from the Bhagavatam. This is right, this is wrong, it's not so bad. You know, Ajamil, he wasn't all these bad things, but very quickly compensated for the whole thing and the lusts and austerity then went back to the spiritual world. Whereas Daksha, you know, was a fancy fellow and he had his head cut off, you know. Then after that he had to take birth again, you know, when it wasn't enough one time. And even still it's kind of doubtful if he actually got the full message in some ways, you know, so on. So there are, you know, one story after another, you know, in the Bhagavatam when we can actually see from that, you know, when we're supposed to be liberal with ourselves, because sometimes, you know, the opposite does happen. We get so heavy with ourselves that we're just trying to push ourselves, you know, up to an impossible standard, and therefore we never get anything properly done because we don't have no patience, you know, like that. You know, no Vaishnava compassion for ourselves. You know? Mm-hmm. So, by associating with Krishna, the Prabhupada, and the Acharyas, and good devotees, then we can see, you know. Basically, Parasara says in Kali Yuga for practical stuff, he gives some things, and Prabhupada recommends Parasara. But he says there's so many things, I can't tell you what's the standard for everything. So he says, like, you know, six good people, they get together and they talk it over, and then together with the influence from the Paramatma and scriptures, they can come to very practical decisions. Okay, chop his head off, or let him go, or else, you know, chop off one finger and let him go. Yeah. Or brand him, you know, brand him on the forehead with a big T for thief or something, you know. So is that okay?
Yes. Thank you, Guru Maharaj.
Okay.
Does anyone else have a question or comment? Well, I had four, Maharaj. Maybe I can get one in. Okay, how's that?
Whatever.
It was really a nice class. I was very interested when you mentioned about that research, the books that have been written about the sense of hearing. The one book that you had cited about the acoustical sense of animals, are you saying there that human hearing is more sensitive than any of the animals?
No. It's just different species have different combinations and stuff like that. You know, it's just, you know, it's very specific. But what you see though is, like, you know, for example, a moth. Because that was one kind of moth. It has what is it? It has, I think it's two on each side of his head. It has two cells, so four cells all together. And coming out of that, each cell is a little like fiber, you know, a little thing sticking out, a twig or something sticking out, and the length of those things and the texture is that they respond to the frequency that bats produce when they're hunting. So the bats have their echolocation going, you know, boop, 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 you know, and they can pick up like moths by that, notice where they are. So, but it's a certain frequency, you know, so by evolution or whatever, this little hearing thing in the moth's ear, it tingles to that frequency. So if it's at a distance, it stimulates one cell, and that tells them to, like, just turn and go the opposite direction, away from the source of the sound. If it's high intensity, which means the bat's near, it tosses them into a completely erratic dive. You know, so the only their hope is to get on the ground. So they just dive, left, right, up, down, and it goes, shoop, you know. And so the only thing they can hear is the sound of death. That's it. Nothing else. Yeah. So it's spooky, you know, seeing this stimulating. But the human being is, of course, a certain developed thing. And, of course, we all know that, you know, dogs can hear higher frequency know, naturally than human beings can hear and stuff like that. But human being is very developed. The fineness of discrimination or something like that. Probably be harder to find other species with, in terms of everything, but really like, you know, beyond human beings and stuff like that. You know?
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Prabhu, if there's nothing else, then perhaps we should let Maharaj go. It's, the last one's like 7:38 here.
Yeah. It's 11:38 in the morning in Boise, Idaho. We had Ratha Yatra yesterday.
Oh, you did also. I'm sorry. That's right. Balabhadra mentioned that. Yeah, because we had a Ratha Yatra here.
So today is the first day of our liberated existence. Yesterday was Independence Day. So we're starting our new liberated life, our new liberal existence.
Aye.
Okay, so thank you all very much. And again, for us, it's always, you know, so enlightening to get a good association with all the devotees like that. And I guess next Friday, where we'll be, next Friday we'll be in San Jose. We'll go one time zone closer to Hawaii. But then we'll bounce off the Pacific Ocean and head back, and we'll be in Tennessee, and we'll stay there pretty much all the way through until October 8th at least, like that.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So you will be available next week, Maharaj?
Yeah, it should be okay if you can tolerate us. You know, your mercy.
Thank you so much. Okay. Well, thank you, Maharaj. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai. Hare Krishna.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna.
Go.